And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to another edition of The Low Post this week. Still reeling from, obviously, the death of Kobe Bryant and his daughter and seven others on that helicopter, and just finished up the jump with Matt Barnes, and you've been telling good Kobe stories all week. Figured let's knock out a quick one, tell some more Kobe stories. How are you feeling?
It's tough. This one felt like when I lost my mom at the beginning of the 2007 season with the Golden State Warriors. I lost her November 27th, and I was just lost, closed off, in shock, and the exact same feeling this time. But I found when I lost my mom in 2007 through the help of my teammates, you know, Steven Jackson, Baron Davis came over every single day and really just got me talking about it and remembering the good times. And I realized that maybe this possibly could be the same, type of outlet in a way of expressing myself. And fortunately I was off. I was supposed to be off until Wednesday, I think, but ESPN called, Amina called me Sunday or hit me Sunday night, like, you know, we would love to have you. And at first I was really hesitant because I didn't know what to say, like many others. You know what I mean? This is a tremendous loss, not only to the NBA community, but to me as a brother, you know, to Vanessa as a husband and father to their kids, knowing their mom, knowing his mom and dad, his sisters, huge. But nevertheless, you know, I decided to do it, and I found the last few days actually talking about it has allowed me to open back up. I mean, I'm still devastated, but I think I was closed off to the world for like 2 or 3 days.
I don't know if this is a human failing on my part or what. I haven't gone past shock yet. Like, I'm still looking down at that memorial from, we're on the balcony yesterday looking at it after the show, and I'm like, and I see 24 and I see his face and I see his daughter's face, and I'm like, yeah, I can't, it just doesn't, it still doesn't feel
not real
to me.
No, I'm 1000%. I mean, you think, you know, Kobe's immortal. You know what I mean? Anybody but Kobe. And, this kind of stuff doesn't happen to Kobe. You know, and I think that's how, you know, especially the city of LA, has taken it. He was more than just a superstar athlete to LA. You know, he was everything. He was, a symbol of hope, not even for athletes, but just the city as a whole. You know, so he's going to be dearly missed.
It's funny you say, I'm not from Los Angeles. I've only started coming here regularly 4 or 5 years ago. I still don't really know the traffic patterns when I plan my trips. My way, how can I go that way at this time? But I spent Sunday night watching a bunch of old Kobe playoff games, like start to finish. I just wanted to see, like, I want to see Kobe in the flow. I don't want to see highlights. I want to see Kobe in the flow. And some were from Shaq and some were from Powell eras. And when you watch just, it's so obvious and stupid, but when you watch games from those two different eras and you start thinking about the context of, like, oh, here was the spacing on this team and here's how they looked on this team, and you're like, oh, all the players are different except one, you know, and maybe Fish too. Mm-hmm. But like, and then you realize, like, well, that's one of the reasons why these fans love him so much, is because he's one of the only one team guys left.
Yeah.
And he was there, and he was only there. He was only in one place. And like, when someone's in your life, in your living room for that many years, it means something different.
He came here as a 17-year-old. He came here as a boy. You know what I mean? And I got here, I'm from Northern California, but I've been here since 98 at UCLA. So you really just got to see him through the years, like he was ours. You know, you got to see him grow up into becoming the tremendous player he is and tremendous man he was, you know, so it's hard to fathom, you know, but they won the first three championships. And like you just mentioned, you know, pretty much wrecked shop, you know, the two constants were Fish and Kobe, and to be able to build another team that can go back to back and have a solid chance to win three in a row, unfortunately, didn't happen. But for him to be able to win, weather the storm, not jump ship. A lot of superstars are leaving these days. Kobe refused to jump ship. I think Jerry West told a story, because I remember I was here. Kobe was close to going to the Clippers, really close, and they were talking about building an arena out there in Orange County by him. Like, but it was interesting hearing Jerry West speak the other day, telling him don't go mess with Donald Sterling, which was a wise word from Jerry.
I don't think he's ever said that before. Yeah, to me, that was new.
I never heard it. you know, I thought it was amazing. Like I said, being in LA at the time, hearing that and thinking that, you know, like Kobe really might go to the Clippers. And I mean, that's what the Clippers would have needed to, you know, really get themselves going, obviously. But, he stuck it out as a Laker, weathered the storm, helped rebuild another team. And some people say, you know, those, you know, the teams that won two championships, like look what he did. Obviously they had talent in Powell and Lamar and Fish and other guys, but, you know, Kobe willed that team to two championships. And then after that broke down again, he weathered the storm with all these young guys and there was no hope of them winning. And I think he knew that, but still he rode that ship until it went down. Like he could have possibly left again for another team and to get one more ring, because when we played, the big thing was six rings.
As you say, you know, he wants six.
Yeah. I want to sit at the table with Mike, only Kobe, you know, would stay and ride this. And, you know, they're one of the worst teams in the league at the end of his career. And it was hard for me to watch as a fan because, you know, I know that, you know, his greatness is just deteriorating with this young team. And, he stuck it out and then finished his career with the 60-point game. And just, it just stamped his historic career and what kind of human he was. You know, in the City of Stars, he was the biggest star.
People sometimes gloss over those two championships because, like, LeBron wasn't ready and the Heat, it was pre-Heat, and like KG got hurt and the Spurs were in this weird in between period. It's hard to win. Like, you can't gloss over those championships. Hard to win.
It takes so much luck to get to, I mean, you have to have skill obviously, but it takes so much luck. Like you mentioned KG not being hurt. You look what just happened with the Warriors.
It's every
getting
year
hurt. You know what I mean? It takes so much more than skill and talented players. A lot of luck plays into it, but you can never discredit. Like you said, it's hard to win champ. There's teams that never won championships. You know, it's hard to win championships. And then on top of that, it's hard to win two in a row. Like they won three in a row, then he won two in a row, you know? So it's funny to me how the, like you said, that gets discredited. And then his place in history to me, you know, to me, I think it's Mike, and I think Kobe and LeBron are right there after him. You know, and that's all due respect to Kareem and Magic and Shaq and these other guys, but Kobe is up there. And I think early on in his career, he was kind of the bad guy because people didn't really understand him. He was young. He was so-called arrogant. He was hard to play with, all this kind of stuff. So he got kind of this label. And I think over the years, we saw him shed that label and become more of a man and become more of a leader and more of a, you know, amazing teammate on and off the court. And he really grew in people's hearts. But to get back to my point, I think he's one of, for sure, to me, top three, but definitely top five.
I'm not ready to have that debate yet because I'm going to have him maybe a little bit lower than that, mm-hmm. than you are, but I don't want to go there. He, the first of those last two is 2009 against the Magic. Mm-hmm. 4-1 Lakers. You then sign with the Magic.
Yeah.
And that year in the Eastern Conference, the following year was 2010.
We dominated.
You were the best team.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point about, to your point about how hard it is to win one, you dominated, you were the best team, and Cleveland is the number one seed, but loses in the second round,
mm-hmm.
to Boston. It's right there for you.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, you're better than the Celtics.
Mm-hmm.
But you know how hard it is to win. You don't win. Whatever happens. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Like, you don't get any more chances for Orlando.
No, and that's been their last chance, you know, and then, but leading into that you know, anticipation of being back in the finals against them was the infamous game we had in 2010 with the ball fake. I think that was later in the season, possibly March, going into April. And it was just so, you know, we knew we had a really good team. We knew they were the team in the West. We knew that we are the best team in the East and we should be playing them. And I think that's what that game was. It was just such a playoff atmosphere type game, and it was a great game. You know, but people get lost in the ball fake, but it was.
I was
really
going to say, do you regret the ball fake? Because now it's all people ask.
It just happened. You know what I mean? I don't regret anything. I think everything is a learning experience. It wasn't something that was planned.
You shouldn't have done it, but just it's like it's become this thing now. It's infamous.
You know what I mean? Him not flinching. You know, but like I said, it was never premeditated. It was just we were going at war, and we talked about it on my podcast. Like, I wanted to fight him, and I told him that. Like, I was ready to fight, and that's kind of just where the game was. But I think what gets lost in this, it was a really amazing back and forth regular season leading into the playoff game, and we came out on top, and it was just an amazing battle. But then, you know, after that, he hits me in free agency. You know, I don't ever answer the phone. I answer a number that I don't even know, and it happens to be Kobe. You know what I mean? He's like, you want to come be a Laker? And I'm like, who's this? You know what I mean? what is going on? This is a trip. And like 4 days later, I was a Laker. But he told me, you know, anyone crazy enough to fuck with me is crazy enough to play with me. And I think I earned his respect that day. And then, you know, I came to the Lakers and kind of the rest is history. Thus, we became, you know, more than teammates. We became brothers.
We're going to talk about that. But, you know, just again, to your point about how hard it is to win, it can be sitting right there for you. You can be the best team. You lose one home game. Then you miss a couple free throws, you lose another. Oh, that's it. Okay. It's over. Like, the margin for error is nothing in the playoffs.
That big word, momentum. You know, they stole, or Boston came in and stole that momentum from us. But then it set up, you know, a rematch, which I think the world wanted to see. You know, talking again to Kobe on my podcast, that 2008 loss to Boston was one of the hardest things he had ever been through in his career. You know, so for them to get a rematch in 2010, to be able to play Boston and finally beat him, because I know he was obsessed with doing it on his own and then beating Boston, and he was able to do both.
I remember at the time people were saying, is this game 7 in 2010, is this the biggest game in NBA history? And it wasn't hyperbole, given the two teams, the stakes, the rematch, the fact that the Lakers were getting pretty close to Boston's all-time number. They're one behind now, championships 17-16. Was it the biggest game in NBA history? Like, that was the discussion. That's how big those finals were. Yeah. And it was not a pretty NBA finals, but you watched those games and like you were tired from watching them. How physical
and emotionally draining, you know, not to mention the physical component, in the game, but it was everything we asked for. You know what I mean? It was one of those old school classic, came down to the stretch, you know, guys hit big shots, but you know, Kobe willed his team. You know, he didn't play amazing by any stretch of the imagination in those finals. He had moments, but he willed his team, you know, to a win and you know, got that second ring with that new group.
Then you come to the Lakers for the 2010-11 season, which ends up being a pivotal season in Laker history.
Yeah.
But you became friends with Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
You said more than teammates. You socialized with him. I want to pull back the curtain on that a little bit. Just like, so, because Kobe is this mythical figure.
Right.
When you guys are socializing, when you guys are hanging, when you guys are just sipping a glass of wine or eating food, like, what did he want to talk about? Did he talk about movies? Did he talk about TV? Did he talk about family?
You know what I mean? I think he has such, like you said, this mythical presence and always scowling, and it's the next competition. It's the next goal, obstacle. Off the court, he was cool. He was relaxed. He was a dude. You know, he talked about everything. You know, we were both going through some personal stuff at the time, and we were talking about family and children, post-career, business. You know, me always encouraging him to show the world the side he shows us, his teammates. You know what I mean? Because he was so closed off. Like you said, he was really closed off, you know, and I think the fact that he opened up to me and, you know, respected me and let me in to see outside of the athlete, outside of this mythical person. I got to see the father. I got to see the friend, the business mind. And it was amazing.
Well, like, I want to know what did he like to eat? What did he like to drink? What did he like? Did he like loud places, quiet places?
Quiet. You know, the time. I mean, we were out in these LA streets a little bit. We were going to black tie events, to private lounges, to private dinners, to mingling in regular settings. Him coming out with me to a bar in Milwaukee one time, and of all cities, it was snowing and I was bored and I didn't have nothing to do. And I'm like, I hit him up and he said, wasn't doing it. I was like, let's go out. And he said, yeah. I'm like, oh, all right, we're going out in Milwaukee. We happened to meet Steven Jackson out there. He was playing for them at the time. He was just a regular dude.
What bar?
I don't even remember.
Was it like, but it's like bars in Milwaukee?
It wasn't a bar. It was like, it was kind of like a bar/club, I guess. It was kind of big, and we sat in a little VIP area. And
okay.
Everyone rounded, you know, where it was in our area. Like, couldn't believe that Kobe was out in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee.
You know what I mean? Of all places. And another crazy story. I remember he used to have his camp out in Santa Barbara, and I was just coming off a knee surgery after the 2010 season. And he has me come out there and he's like, well, we got to play, I think it was two on, we got to play 2-on-2 for these kids. And I haven't really done nothing on my knee yet. I was coming, you know, I came back.
Kids, like college kids that are just playing there?
Younger kids. I think it was younger kids. It was younger kids, like young teenagers. But I'm, you know, I came back off of my knee a little early. Didn't really do nothing in the playoffs. So I was really kind of just recovering still from a knee surgery, so to speak. And I'm like, okay, so I think we're just going to go out there and mess around. When I tell you, Zach, he played as hard as he could against these kids, like blocking their shots, dunking on them, made one kid fall down. Like he was in playoff mode versus, you know, 12 or 13 year old kids. And it just showed me like, he's like, no, nothing's easy. I'm not giving them nothing. You know what I mean? Like he wanted guys to work. He wanted kids to work. He wanted to understand like it's not easy being this. It's not easy being Kobe. Like nothing is sweet about this, you know? So that story is when I took my kid out to, you know, to work out with them for his, for their 10th birthday surprise. At the end, he made the boys run 17. So they're, you know, 9 turning 10. I think it was probably their first 17. And he made them race against each other. And one of my twins won. So the other one, Isaiah, had to keep running. And he started crying and breaking down. And we were trying to encourage him. And Kobe said to the other twin, Carter, I'll give you a left-handed shot. Carter's right-handed. Carter, I'll give you a left-handed shot. If you make it, your brother doesn't have to run no more. And Carter made it. And then
Whoa. He
went over there and Carter hugged Isaiah and then Kobe hugged both of them. It was just like, it was dope because like I said, it's, you know, it's not easy. You know, a lot of people, parents want to baby kids and sugarcoat stuff, but I'm sure there was time and place for all that. But when the competitive Kobe, you know, rang true in several aspects of his life.
I want to talk about that 2010-11 season a bit. Coming off two straight championships, expectations. People expected you guys to win again.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans in the first round. Chris Paul has a monster series. You guys beat him 4-2, and then Dallas is the second round. Dallas ends up winning the title that year. But I just take me back. Like that year wasn't as smooth in the regular season as people expected it to be. So when you get to that Dallas series, what's the state of the team? Do you guys feel like, okay, we're starting to figure it out? We still feel like we're the best team?
Let me recall. It was a crazy season. You know, that's the season that was Phil's last season.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled us in a room and told us he was stepping away and he had cancer. And it was, I don't exactly remember when that happened, but I know it was in the midst of things. And going into the Dallas series, obviously, you know, we're as a team, this was my first time there, we're thinking we have a chance to go for a three-peat. And we just ran into a buzzsaw in Dallas. Dirk was playing out of his mind. Jason Terry was playing out of his mind. And very quickly, they took the momentum of the series and they swept us. And that team went on. Did they sweep us or did we win one game?
Nope, they swept you.
They swept us, right? Yeah. So that was a year I was coming back. Like I said, it wasn't a perfect season, but we had good momentum. We had a very solid bench. I remember I went down in late February, early March for a meniscus. So I came back and that kind of after I got back, I was like, okay, let's make this stretch run. But I wasn't fully healthy, down the stretch. And I don't know what was missing, but something was missing. Long story short, we get swept out of the second round and that's the end of the era of Phil Jackson and really the last time, you know, the team had really been relevant.
There's a lockout after that. Mm-hmm. They trade Lamar.
Yeah.
Right before the next season. So here's what happens. I look back at game one of that series as the moment when it fell apart for the Lakers. So here's what happens at the end of game one. I rewatched the end this morning. Dallas Lakers game one.
Was that when Bynum clotheslined?
No, that's the end of the series. The series is over by that point. They've stolen your momentum. Game one is Lakers are up three with about a minute to go. Dirk hits a one legger. He's dribbling left. He pulls up leaning right. Classic Dirk shot. Brings the Mavs within one with 40 seconds left. Kobe comes down next possession. No timeout. Drives. Tries to kick it. Jason Terry steals the pass with about 25 seconds left. Powell fouls Dirk Nowitzki on a side out of bounds. Dirk hits two free throws. Mavs go up by one with 19 seconds left. This is the play of the game now. You guys call timeout down one. Inbound to Powell. DHO with Kobe. Jason Kidd blows it up and steals the ball. Gets fouled. Makes one of two. You guys are down two with 3 point something seconds left. Do you remember what happens on the last play of the game?
Was that Steve Blake got a corner three?
No, that's in the Denver series the next year.
Yeah,
Steve.
No, you got
to
remind me.
Kobe misses a three, catch and shoot three, beautifully designed out of bounds play.
Wide open.
Great look for him. I just – that game, like Dallas in that playoff run like kind of stole a couple of big games, and they stole that one from you with some late game execution, like a wily Jason Kidd play. Do you remember him blowing up that dribble handoff? What do you remember about like?
It's just like we mentioned with the Orlando and Boston, how they came in. It's like when you can go and steal one, and they came on a homecoming and stole one. You know what I mean? And that's huge. It's momentum has shifted. You know what I mean? So then now it puts so much pressure on us in game two because we got to salvage one at home.
See, in my head, as someone just starting covering the NBA, but a big diehard NBA guy, the Lakers had this air of invincibility about them at that time where you lose game one like that. And in my head, I'm like, oh, they're just going to come out and win game two. They're going to, this is fine. This is, but you were never in this series again. You were like, they won game two by double digits. And then after that, it just spiraled out of control. So what is it like when it just spirals out of control? Do you feel it like they've figured
it's tough
out?
Because we figure, you know, we have Kobe. So it only takes him to get hot in game three. You know, there's still a lot of confidence. Although we knew we gave, you know, we gave two away at home. We have Kobe still. You know, so we still have the X factor, so to speak, and we're thinking we're going into Dallas very confident, especially because the team had won two before.
So you're still confident,
yeah,
down 2-0.
Absolutely. You know, especially because the team had won two in a row prior. So we're going in with confidence, knowing that, hey, all we got to do, you know, we definitely got to get this game three, but if we can get game four, get it back home even, we'll be back on track. And we never came back from Dallas.
The wheels kind of fell off.
Completely.
And then Bynum.
Clotheslines, Barea.
Just drills Barea.
And
gets thrown out of the game.
Gets suspended for the first game the next season,
I think. First five games.
Was it? Okay, yeah, I knew that the suspension had carried over. But then you bring in Mike Brown, and it was there was a disconnection between ownership at the time, which the son, well, I want to say Jim was in charge at that time. It was a little ugly over there. And, you know, once Phil was gone, it was everything that Phil had touched was gone. Pictures, sayings, anything that resembled Phil was fired. Along with staff maybe a couple guys, I think Gary Vee was able to stick, maybe a very few guys were able to stick, but that whole Phil Jackson era was out, wiped away. They were done with it. Like I said, I don't know what was really going on with management and Phil at the time, but it was just a bad energy. In comes Mike Brown, and the wheels were off. The wheels fell off that next season.
I still made the second round.
Yeah,
but you just didn't feel it?
I didn't feel it. You know, I didn't think there was a – I didn't think he demanded respect from the guys, you know, and I think that's a huge thing as a coach coming into a new situation, especially coaching a player as talented as Kobe and a team that's had so much success. He didn't demand respect from the jump, you know, and then I think we lost to Oklahoma City in the second round that year, right?
4-1.
Yeah. It was, you know, that was a young OKC team, but it was just like you saw the door shutting. And then that's when Mike Brown wanted to, you know, I was, again, towards the end of the season, got hurt again with a bad sprain, was trying to play through it. He ends up benching me for, Devin Ebanks.
Devin Ebanks. I had forgotten that he started playoff games for the Lakers I was watching.
I was having a rough series, you know, granted, but he just sat me down and we had some back and forth because we didn't agree. And that was kind of the end of my situation. The following year I went to the Clippers and it was war on the Lakers. You know, I wanted to kill them every single time, not because of anything more than just the way that it ended in the Mike Brown era. And it, you know, Mike and I have made peace since then, but the Mike Brown era with the Lakers was a mess. And it was disappointing.
I was going to ask about that Oklahoma City series. So that playoff run, a really forgotten fun series against the Nuggets in the first round that went seven.
7 games, right? Yeah.
And it went seven despite the Lakers going to Denver and winning game four and going up 3-1. And I watched the end of game four this morning. I knew Steve Blake had hit a big shot in that game. Ramon Sessions hit another big shot. Two threes in the last minute, one by Sessions and one by Blake, both set up by Kobe. Kobe, Powell, pick and roll. Powell kicks to Sessions for three, and then Kobe directly to Blake off a double team. Facilitator Kobe was engaged in that game. But that was a fun series.
Yeah.
But then Oklahoma City in 2012, could you feel like you said the doors were shutting? That was like a passing of the torch series, right? And did you it sounds like you felt that at the time.
Looking back, not necessarily at the time, I think looking back shortly after that, you're just like, yeah, that was the shift in power. And the Lakers weren't necessarily the team to beat anymore, you know, after that. You know, I think we get swept out one round. Excuse me, we get swept out 2010. We are 2010, 11, 11, 12. We come back in the second round and get beat 4-1. And it's just like, at the time, you're frustrated. I'm moving on. But then going to another team, like the Lakers are always the team. Like, okay, like we got to get by the Lakers. And it wasn't that anymore. And that was kind of the beginning of a long run of, them being one of the worst teams in the league, which is crazy to think. You know, me being a lifelong Laker fan, being a huge Kobe fan, given a chance to play with them, fighting for a title, for them just to kind of go to, from that to, you're not, you don't fear them no more. You look forward to just kicking their ass every single time. And with the Clippers, that's what we did. We tried to beat them down every single game, and we were pretty good at it. And like I said, from that time there, it was probably like a five-year span where they just weren't very good.
I'm guessing if I watched head-to-head matchups of you against Kobe's teams, that you guarded Kobe a fair bit.
Uh-huh.
What was the I don't want to say scariest, because NBA players aren't scared of each other, but what was like the moment when he had the ball against you? I don't know if it was a position on the court, like a spot on the court where you're like, oh, he's really good here, or a move that you're like, I got to watch out for this move. Like, what was it? What's in your head?
As soon as he gets over half court, you know, he can get you from so many different spots. You know, the ISO up top, you know, he had a tremendous crossover, you know, and if you played the crossover well, he would shot fake you until you had to jump and you would foul him. Down on the pinch post area and the mid block area, his footwork to me is second to none. His pivot and being able to pivot off both feet, and then his shot fake. You know what I mean? Like, he mastered that shot fake, and he can throw it at you one time, two times, three times, four times, five times. And by that time, you're going to jump. You know what I mean? So I used to tell him, like, you pump fake me too many times, I'm just going to foul the shit out of you. You know that. And he's like, oh, I know. You know what I mean? So he was prepared for it.
It's funny. Coaches, it's the easiest thing for coaches to say. Don't jump at the pump fake. How many times have they said that about Dwayne Wade and DeMar DeRozan? Don't jump. But if there's something about it, you can't help it, I guess.
It's so fluid within the game that it really looks like a shot every time. So you have to contest a shot. I mean, contesting still doesn't do much. He's still going to make it. But to me, guarding Kobe was always just knowing who he was physically, and then his mental preparation and how he tried to mentally dominate you as well. You just wanted to make him work. You always knew that regardless whether you play good defense or not, he's probably still going to end up with 30, because he didn't give a shit. He was going to take 30 shots to get 30 points if that's what it needed for the team to win.
He also could will himself, much like, you know, the famous Pacers Bulls 98 game 7 where Michael didn't have it and he just willed himself to the free throw line. Kobe could get 15 to 18 free throws needed to.
There's no question. Like I said, he would slow the whole game down, get you on that block, and you're at your mercy. And he was a willing passer. You know what I mean? That's what people don't realize, that later in his career, he was a willing passer, realizing that, okay, if I'm drawing two or three different guys, I'm trusting my teammates to knock these shots down. And Fish hit a lot of big shots, obviously, in their career together. And Steve Blake hit a lot of big shots for us. So he was someone who was a willing passer, too. So it really just made it tough, but it was always – like I've heard Dwayne speak and I've heard LeBron speak, like, he was who everybody was chasing. Everybody wanted to gain his respect. So when you got a chance to imagine every single night, you're going to get that person's best. We're trying to knock you down every single night.
That's a good point. People talk about that with teams.
But Kobe, Kobe got it every single. Kobe always had the best defender on every team guarding him and looking forward to playing him every single night for his whole entire career. That's crazy.
Well, you would, and That pinch post area, you know, I watched a couple of 2001 playoff games. That's the year they went 15-1 and just destroyed everybody.
Dominated everybody.
He would get the ball there, and that's Kobe's, like, in his fifth or sixth year then. He's in his absolute athletic prime. Mm-hmm. There was nothing you could do.
He can't do nothing.
He could go left. He could go right. He had 5,000 different moves. There was literally nothing you could do.
And he mastered the triangle, so he knew how to shortcut it and cheat it. You know what I mean? And I learned that once I got there, that we would be going and trying to learn the and then once we get Kobe involved, he knew how to shortcut every time and get to that pinch post. So he would mess your hole, like, I'm supposed to be running that spot, and all of a sudden Kobe's there. So you got to adjust and get out the way. So I remember Phil saying, like, he created the triangle to slow down Mike. And then I think he obviously implemented with LA to slow down Kobe because he was so amazing. But then through that triangle hit, they still found ways, like you said, to get on that pinch post and be absolutely unguardable.
I just have to say, watching some of those 2001 games, the media is guilty of it. Because it's fun to do, frankly, we compare players to each other. Yeah. And so there was always was it Shaq's team? Is it Kobe's team? And they felt it. It broke them apart. Mm-hmm. That playoff run. Now, I know Shaq was finals MVP. Shaq was the fulcrum of what they did on offense.
Kobe was absolutely amazing.
That was
absolutely amazing.
It was as close. Kobe averaged 37-7 in that playoff run. It was as close to perfect synchronicity between two superstar players, mm-hmm. that because of their positions didn't overlap at all, which is part of what made them so good. But that one playoff run, I know Shaq got the Finals MVP. He was the centerpiece.
It was
perfect. It was devastating. It was as close to nirvana for two superstar players as we'll ever see, I think.
Yeah, on the same page, yeah. And to think that Allen Iverson's little ass came in here and stole one, you know what I mean? Or they would have went 16-0. It's scary because, like I said, I mean, I'm a fan before I get in the league of the Lakers and what they're doing, and then getting in the league and seeing it, but just wishing for the sake of history that they could have stuck it out. You know what I mean? Imagine what they could have, if they could have grew old together and played another 3, 4, 5 years together. You know, Kobe spoke on in the podcast, you know, obviously their connection was what people talked about, but you know, he also spoke on how dominant the Spurs were and what kind of amazing team they had. But you know, as a fan of it, I still think if they could have stuck together, they would have got another handful of rings.
The problem is that Shaq was starting to break down physically. And that's what Kobe, Kobe was right. Kobe said he didn't trust Shaq to age well, and he was right about that. But yeah, no, they were, any last Kobe stories you want to tell? I mean, you finally got to see his practice habits up close. I don't know if there's any other thing you want to tell before we let you go.
Just a good guy, man. Like I said, I think the world got a piece of him. I got a piece of him, but I got to see the other side too, which was so amazing. And to see him being the father and to see that he always sent my kids shoes. Every time he and I talked to us about my kids, about their team, we play in the same AAU tournament. So he would always sneak over with everyone trying to grab on him and security having to clear one out the way to come sneak a peek at the boys' game for 2 or 3 minutes. He would always try to make a time to come watch the kids. And I just think, like I said, the father, I think, is what bonded both of us. We teased each other, or I teased him, about always having girls. And I, you know, he had 4 girls and I had 3 boys. And that was a back and forth thing. And Vanessa wanting more, you know, another chance to have boys. Like, there was just so many little things that I got to do with them. Not claiming we were best friends by any means, but we had a real connection. And every time we saw each other, it was love. And to think where it came from, you know what I mean? Because there was always a mutual respect. But until we almost got in a fight in Orlando through a ball fake, that brought me to the Lakers, brought us closer and gave us a friendship that I'll cherish forever.
Matt Barnes, thank you for coming on and telling some stories. And it's been essential to hear from people like you this week. So thanks for bringing all the time.
Appreciate it, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.